All right, so tell how many of the people here have a securities license, either broker dealer or IA license? So about half. So of those that don't, how many of you are familiar with the Division of Securities? Have a little bit of sense of what we do, hopefully because you haven't gotten in trouble at some point with the Division of Securities. But we're part of the Department of Commerce in the state, and we license and regulate all the broker dealers and investment advisors in the state. But really, the bulk of our time is taken up in doing audits and investigations where there's accusations of some kind of, you know, wrongdoing or violations of the securities laws. And what I want to cover today and give you a sense of kind of where we're going, I'm going to go over some of the trends of kind of where I see, where I think we're at right now in the cycle, because our business definitely is cyclical. When we see drops in the market, that's when a lot of Ponzi schemes and other things collapse and we get super busy. When people are making money in the markets, they're far less likely to file complaints with our office, so we see a drop-off there. I want to give you a sense of where things are at and the trend right now, what kinds of enforcement cases we're generally seeing, and some of the tips that I have for you guys to make sure you don't get in trouble with our office at any point down the road. Ken is going to get way down into the weeds on some of the nitty-gritty stuff that really impacts your business. The DOL's new fiduciary rule, I assume you guys are probably hearing about that from your firms. Everybody is worked up about this, and what is it really going to mean? He's going to get into some of that. He's also going to cover digital investment advice and whether or not a robot can be a fiduciary and how that actually all plays out in practice, because we're seeing a huge uptick now in the amount of automated robot advice that's out there. So I'm going to start, hopefully not with boring statistics, but a few statistics to give you a sense of where we're at. So this is the number of complaints that we see come into our office on an annual basis just here in Utah. The first dot, the 225, is actually an average from the year 2009 to 2012. So this is right in the wake of the Great Recession when our business was really going through the roof. We were slammed with the number of complaints. If we did like a long-term chart going back 15, 20 years, I think the average on the number of complaints we see coming in is probably just around 100, maybe a little over 100. So we had a huge spike. Since then, you can see the numbers are clearly coming down. I think the reasons for that are pretty simple. The market's doing better. People are making money. They feel a little bit better about things. They're far less likely to complain about their advisor. They're far less likely to have a Ponzi scheme collapse on them. That really all happened mostly back in that 2009 to 2012 period. Same thing mostly reflected in our number of new investigations that we're opening each year. There's a little more noise in those numbers, but there is a clear downtrend, I think, from 2009 to today, where you see the number almost cut in half from where it was back at the peak in 2009 to 2012. New audits, this is the flip side of it. Because we've had fewer resources that we've had to dedicate to those fraud investigations, we've had more bandwidth to do more audits. So we're getting out a little more to the broker-dealer firms, to the IA firms, to do those audits. Really, we were at a point in 2009, 2010, where we couldn't do any routine audits because everybody was taken up. It was all hands on deck to deal with the various frauds that were collapsing and the number of complaints that we had. Now we're able to have the examiners that work under Ken get back out there, do some routine audits. So just because your firm, your branch office, hears from us that we want to come out and do a visit, it doesn't mean that we got a complaint. Doesn't necessarily mean that anybody's in trouble. We try to get out to every firm and branch office on like a five-year cycle to get out and visit them and make sure that there's a touch, that we can work with you to make sure that everything is in compliance and that you're on a smooth sailing. So the number of enforcement cases, the last one I'll show here, more or less level. There's a little bit of a decline in the number of new cases. This includes both criminal, administrative, and civil cases that the Division of Securities has filed. This one is just the number of licensees through our office. So both on the broker-dealer side on the left and on the investment advisor side on the right, you can see that there's a continuing uptrend. And this really has been a long-term continuing uptrend in the number of licensees we see in Utah. There was a slight downtick in the 2009-2010 time period, but really we're at all-time highs in both of these categories. Growth on the IA side is at an even higher rate than it is on the broker-dealer side, especially when it comes to the firms. These are individuals that are licensed with BD firms or IA firms. But on the firm level, we're actually seeing some contraction among the number of BDs that are licensed out there. There's some consolidation in the industry. The trend is for more people to go to the investment advisory side and fewer people to go into the broker-dealer side. The number of broker-dealer agents still far outnumbers investment advisor reps, but we are seeing the growth really on the investment advisory side. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Part of it is I think the insurance agents, a lot of insurance agents are now also going out getting an investment advisory license so that they can provide advice across the spectrum, not just on insurance needs, but that they can advise someone, you know, on a more fulsome financial plan, and if they've got securities in their portfolio, so they can provide some advice on those as well. So we've licensed quite a few new IA firms on the state level in Utah over the last couple of years, and we're seeing the number of applications we receive really hit some new highs. I wanted to go through some enforcement trends of what we're seeing in the state. And the reason I'm going to go through some of these enforcement cases is not because I think anybody in this room would be involved in them. I want you to be aware of what is going on out there so that when you have a client approach you and say, hey, you know, my home teacher just offered me this really good investment deal, let me tell you about it, and the red flags are going off, you know, and the warning bells, that you'll recognize some of the things that are out there right now and hopefully not just give them the advice to steer clear of that, but even refer it over to our office so that we can do something about it. So Ponzi schemes, I mean, that just never goes away. And the most common type of Ponzi scheme we see still in the state is connected to real estate. So it could be somebody, you know, who claims they're a fix and flip artist and you can invest in their business maybe on an individual home or maybe in a pooled investment vehicle of some kind. And in the process, they're actually stealing a lot of the money, and a lot of the money from new investors is just being used to create the illusion of profits by paying off the old investors. That is a time-tested, Ponzi scheme that is just never going away and is probably 50% of our business. Are Ponzi schemes related to real estate. And most of the ones you see in the news of people being prosecuted even right now, that's what it was. It was some kind of Ponzi scheme linked to a real estate deal of some type. The way you're going to recognize these things, it's kind of like your grandmother used to teach you. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. Somebody who's promising ridiculous rates of return and then guaranteeing people against loss, it's not going to be real. You know, those tend to be scams where they're stealing money. Ponzi, Madoff, you know, they're huge examples of it, but it happens on small scale, on a large scale. We see it all the time. A couple of new ones I did want to highlight, advanced fee schemes. I thought this had gone. You know, we used to see these 15, 20 years ago, and then they pretty much went away, and we've seen a real uptick again. So these are, sometimes they're called prime bank schemes. It's the easiest way I think to think about an advanced fee scheme is you're going to pay for essentially a lottery ticket, or let's call it a ticket to ride on the rainbow, and you're going to slide down that rainbow and there's going to be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that you're going to get. So you're going to put in a little bit of money now with the promise of some kind of huge return that's going to be unlocked with your little bit of money. I'll give you a couple of examples. So we have this woman, Ann Delvecchio, who's now going through her third criminal prosecution for this same kind of story. Her story was that she had one of 12 licenses in the world for some kind of super duper trader license that only 12 people in the world can hold at any given time. This is all made up, of course. And that she had made billions of dollars because of her access to this special trading privilege that she had. And she has $5 billion that are locked up in an account overseas. Now, she has to pay off Homeland Security and Interpol and maybe the IRS and some other people to free up these funds so that she can domesticate them and bring them into the United States. And so she is cash poor right now, but that's because her account is locked up and she doesn't have access to her $5 billion that was sitting, I think it was in a bank in Latvia, was the story that she was telling. So I need, you know, $100,000 now to pay off all of these entities that need to be paid off, and then it's going to free up my $5 billion account, and I will pay you back $1 million in 2 weeks, you know, if you give me $100,000 now. So you're going to make 10 times your money in 2 weeks. Well, if you annualize that, that's a really good rate of return, you know, that we would all really like to be making. But, of course, the pot of gold never quite materializes, and instead, 2 weeks later, you get another story that, oh, well, now there's this other hurdle. You know, now I got to pay so-and-so or Interpol got involved and I have to pay them off, or, you know, whatever it is. And it just keeps going on and on and on. There's always another excuse as to why the money hasn't been freed up yet. But she's incredibly convincing, very charismatic, and that despite the fact that she is 83 years old, has a glass eye, uses a walker, but people believe in her. I mean, people just believe in her. So she's raised, I think, about $15 million here in the last few years from, I'm not sure, several dozen different investors that she's conned out of this money, and nobody ever gets paid. Yes? Well, so she's moved around a lot. Most recently, I think she was up in Bountiful. She's in Utah. This is all in Utah. She was in Ogden. I think she was in Bountiful before when we took the criminal action. I think most recently she was in Ogden. She's lived with some of these investors. They buy in so much, she's living with them. One of them actually may have been her lover, I think, at some point. But, you know, it's just all great, crazy stories. But the idea here is I think that when one person has success with some kind of scam, word spreads. It's like they all belong to some club. You know, it's like the Rotary Club, but for fraudsters. They all get together every month.
They're all on an email list.
Yes, they're all on some email list. So they copy each other.
How does anybody buy into that ever?
You know, it's a great question, and I wish I had the answer to that. She is convincing. And if you, even in court, hearing her tell her, because she still, even after she was convicted, she believes, you know, and she's telling the judge, this is real, and I am going to get all this money back, and I'm going to pay everybody back, you know, and she's incredibly convincing. During the criminal trial, she was living with one of the investors, and this investor is attending the criminal trial, would not cooperate in our investigation because she believed it was real, still believed it was real, even though she's watching the criminal trial and even though the jury convicted her. This investor still believed. So I don't know how to answer that question. But well, I do think Ann Delvecchio is crazy.
Yeah, I mean,
there's no question about that. With all the investors, I don't know what to say about them. But we have seen a rash of now these types of cases. She's the most egregious example. And some of the others, honestly, are a little more convincing. There was another one just recently here where the money was in Hong Kong. And the story was more plausible. It's because the money had been earned overseas, and the claim was that the value-added tax had not been paid in Hong Kong, and so the money couldn't be released until after these taxes were paid. And then there was a correspondent bank in St. Vincent and the Grenadines that they were working through to get this paid because Americans couldn't pay it directly. You know, there was a whole story. But there were documents that, you know, had been made up that backed up the story. You could call this banker in St. Vincent and the Grenadines who would tell you the story and back it up. It turns out that he works for a bank that actually doesn't exist. You know, but they had created a website, had the paperwork, and made it look pretty legitimate. And lots of people are investing on this idea that if we pay the value-added tax and get these fees taken care of, then this, in this case, it was a few hundred million in the account in Hong Kong is going to be released. And you're going to get a huge windfall for fronting the money that I don't have to pay these taxes because my accounts are all frozen. It's that kind of story. So anytime you're paying in advance with a little bit of money, in quotations, I mean $100,000 is not a little bit of money, but some money up front to unlock a huge sum of money in the near-term future, that's what I'm talking about with an advance fee scheme. And anything you see along those lines, it's always and everywhere a scam. Always. I mean, this is not legitimate. It's never legitimate. Hong Kong doesn't even have a value-added tax, you know, but people don't know that, and so the story sounds plausible. If you hear that, please report it to our office. The other common thing we're seeing right now are technology startups. So, I mean, we all love technology startups, right? And we hear it in the news, and, you know, we think Uber is going to take over the world, and when they have self-driving cars, it's going to be great. And, you know, companies are going into the private business of building rockets, and Elon Musk is going to set up a colony on Mars. We have lots of brilliant people putting a lot of money into technology startups, but we get some really creative ones, and then they offer the opportunity to get in on the ground floor to investors. I'll just give you one example of this. We had a guy who had created this nanonutrient water. You know, he had a secret formula. He wouldn't tell anybody about what was in the water, but he had these nanoparticles in the water that if you drank it, it would cure diabetes, it would cure cancer, pretty much anything that was wrong with you, it was going to make better. You could also pour it into the diesel tank of a truck or your car or whatever, and it will run for, you know, you get tremendous gas mileage by pouring this into your tank. You could feed it to livestock, and the livestock grow four times as fast as they would normally. You know, it does everything, basically, this nanonutrient water. Well, yeah, I'm making it sound ridiculous. He obviously was a much better salesman at selling this, and he could show you, you know, fake documents he had gotten from Brazilian chicken farmers that, you know, had testimonials about how fast their chickens grew when they were on this water, and so people invest in the company. You know, if you hear about those suspicious-sounding new technologies, we had another one that was a gold extractor where you could take the tailings from an old mine. You know, so after Kennecott or Rio Tinto has finished with whatever they're doing and extracted all the copper and the valuable minerals, and they got the tailings that are left over, this machine was so sensitive that you run it through their machine and it could still extract very valuable quantities of gold. In fact, the sales pitch was it was so sensitive, you can go down to Home Depot and buy a bag of sand and run it through the machine and you're going to get gold, you know, out of that bag of sand. Well, people believe that, you know, and they invest in the company and they buy stock in this company. It's completely worthless and their money is sold and it's just a shell company that has no operations and no profits. Yeah.
You know, Brian, I got a text, ironically, just last week, and I don't know who the text came from. It was an anonymous text, but it said something about your second check is in the mail.
Yeah.
You know, is that something that you guys are able to regulate?
Yes. So we're able to help with a lot of those. Some of them end up at the Division of Consumer Protection if it's not really a securities offering. You know, so like you won a lottery that you didn't remember ever entering, but you need to pay some fee in order to get your winnings, you know, from the lottery, that kind of stuff. We see a lot of that kind of thing. Or your check from, you know, you don't know what. I don't remember why. Why would I be getting this check? I don't know. But then if you follow up, you find out, well, you need to pay some fee first. It's all a variation on the advance fee scheme. There is a pot of gold. You just need to pay the ticket price to unlock that pot of gold, and then you're going to get lots of money. Forward it to us. Absolutely. Yeah, forward it to us. We will do what we can. If we don't have jurisdiction over it, we'll send it to the agency that does, Consumer Protection. The problem we have is a lot of these actually originate from overseas, and then it's incredibly hard to chase those people down. And then they want you to send via Western Union, you know, money overseas or wire money overseas, and that's almost always a dead end for us once the money goes overseas. It's really hard to track those down. Violations we find in exams, I won't go through all those, but you know, these are the common things when Ken sends one of his examiners out on a branch exam. By far the most common problem we find is not keeping adequate books and records. So just a plug for that, keep good records. You know, and I'm not talking obscure stuff that you would have never thought, you know, that you need to keep records. It's the easy stuff. You know, your communications with your clients. Yeah, you got to keep that stuff. Transaction records. All that paperwork needs to be kept. And that's the first thing we're going to ask for when we come in on an exam, is for all those books and records. And if they don't have it, or you know, it's just not kept, or it's been lost in some fashion, it's not that that kind of violation in and of itself is going to lead to some, you know, terrible action or you're going to lose your license. You're not. But it's just a red flag that shows, well, you know, this isn't a very compliant shop if they're not serious about keeping their books and records. Yeah, did you have another question you were going to ask?
I just remember hearing an event, it was overseas, it triggered my mind, that firms are kind of blackmailing, particularly you, with social media and situations, and asking them for money.
Yes.
To buy off what they're reporting to Square.
Yeah, and it's the same problem with ransomware, where they can hold something hostage, you know, or take down your system or whatever, or expose certain things if you don't pay up. And that's becoming an increasing problem, and usually it's being carried out from overseas, so those are very hard to track down. But yeah, the ransomware problems tied to that, and it's for businesses often that are targeted with those, where they hack your system, take over your client account files, whatever it is, and aren't going to release it unless you pay a certain amount. And a lot of those times, those go unreported because a lot of companies, there's been studies, they just pay it, you know, because they don't want the publicity. And they really have hacked your system. They've locked up your system, and your computer system's completely shut down, and you don't have access to any of your data unless you pay them off. And companies will just pay it and not say anything. So that's why it's often unreported. It is a growing problem. Outside business activities, just to be aware of, anybody who, you know, works like in an OSJ capacity or anything like that, if, because we see rogue agents, you know, it's not the firm that's running the scam, but they've got an agent who on the side is running some kind of Ponzi scheme or, you know, some other, you know, promissory notes that they're selling to people. And they may or may not be reporting that fully in their outside business activities, but if there's anything that should tip off the firm and the firm doesn't follow up on it to find out, well, what is this agent doing on the side, the firm can be on the hook for that. So just something to be aware of. Our areas of enforcement focus currently, we're particularly looking at alternative investment products, particularly when they're sold by insurance agents and they cross the line into the securities arena, but they don't have a securities license. So if you're doing seminars and advertising, you know, that you're a guru and can provide all this advice and help you retire safely and securely, and really what you're selling is equity indexed annuities, which of course you only need an insurance license to sell that product. But if you're advising people to liquidate their securities holdings and giving them advice about their current investments, which are mutual funds or stocks or whatever they are, and you're getting a commission then to have them liquidate that product and buy an insurance product, you actually have to be licensed as a securities rep, an investment advisor or a broker-dealer agent in order to give that advice on the sell side of the transaction. And we do run across that a lot with people who are not securities licensed but are giving advice on securities. Yeah.
Include saying, yeah, you should liquidate your 401k and roll it over into my equity index annuity.
Yes.
Is that, I mean, that we run into that all the time. So what do we call you and say, hey, this agent has now told my client to do this?
Yeah. So if you've run into that where somebody's given that advice and they're not securities licensed, and you know what the client is telling you is that, yeah, they looked at my account statement, they told me, oh, I can't afford to take the risk of the market, I really need to liquidate these mutual funds or whatever it is. Yeah, that's something where they're crossing the line. Now, this is not going to result in a criminal action, probably not going to result in anybody's license being taken away, but we're trying to crack down on that area just because we see a lot of it. And we got a couple of big test cases going right now for very large insurance producers who this is their business model. Scare you about the stock market, tell you this is super risky, you can't afford this risk, liquidate that 401k, buy my equity indexed annuity. All right, if you're going to say that, you better have either an investment advisory license or, you know, somebody in the firm who's securities licensed who's giving the advice on that recommendation to sell a security. That is something we're trying to crack down on. Affiliate relationships with credit unions doesn't really apply as much to this group, but just give you a quick sense of what we're doing there. We're concerned about credit unions who have a broker-dealer firm come into the credit union and then they refer you over, the credit union customers, to that broker-dealer who sits right in the branch, right in the credit union branch, to do your investment services, which is fine as long as the customer clearly understands that he's not dealing with XYZ credit union for the investment services. He's dealing with XYZ broker-dealer firm or investment advisory firm. But a lot of times the customers never recognize that because all the paperwork and all the marketing is marketed as the credit union. Well, the credit union can't hold themselves out as providing investment services if they're not a licensed broker-dealer or investment advisor. Those need to be marketed under the umbrella of the licensed BD or IA firm. And that's something we've been making a push on, and we're going to have several actions that are probably coming on that. In our settlement negotiations, we're pushing for more admissions rather than letting people neither admit nor deny. If we do allow you to neither admit nor deny, but you don't live up to the terms of a settlement agreement, you don't pay a fine or violate the act later, we have built-in provisions that will turn that into an admission that can then be converted into a judgment. I wanted to run over just a couple of significant enforcement cases from this past year that illustrate some of these principles. D. Randall, you guys may have heard of him. He's been in the news quite a bit lately. He ran a very large insurance business, mostly out of like Woods Cross, and some of it was in Salt Lake County as well. But $70 million Ponzi scheme that he's running on the side. So it wasn't the insurance business that was causing the problem. It was a LEAP program that he was running. So his insurance agents were out there working with their clients, and they would convince them to buy a very large whole life policy that really they didn't have the assets to afford the premiums on. But the story was, you can buy into this promissory note investment on the side. So you put your money into the promissory note investment with D, And it's going to generate such a high rate of return because he was paying, you know, 18% interest on these promissory notes, that you'll make enough money off those promissory notes to pay your premiums on the whole life policy. So don't worry about those expensive premiums, because actually you're going to get, it's going to be paid for out of this side investment deal. Well, the side investment deal was just a Ponzi scheme. It's not generating 18% return. He's using money from new investors to pay off the interest of the old investors. And what he claimed was backing it was subprime auto loans, and some of it was real estate, but that was bogus. So these insurance agents, most of them, I believe, you know, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, I don't think they knew that D. Randall was running a Ponzi scheme, but they're recommending to their clients that they buy into this product that they have not thoroughly vetted, that they've not researched, and that they really know next to nothing about, so that they can get the commission for selling that large whole life policy. So D is going to prison. I mean, he's already pled guilty, and his sentencing is in February of next year, and he'll probably go to prison for a long time. But the insurance agents, and there were over a dozen of them that we ended up taking administrative actions against, most of them are getting a bar from the securities industry, which will probably result in them losing their insurance license as well, because they were recommending to clients a side deal that really they had done no vetting of. So that's the kind of cautionary tale there. If you're going to recommend something to your clients, you better have done a little bit of due diligence, you know, because they had not vetted any of these promises that D. Randall was making. But D's paying him a huge commission for referring these people over to him, and that's really what was motivating these sales.
So there was no real estate behind it?
No. Most of them were linked to this subprime auto lending business that D claimed he was running. Was how they were generating the huge rates of return. But yeah, when you got into the finances, it was just a pure Ponzi scheme. The underlying business is not generating any income. He's using money from new investors to pay the interest off to his old investors, and the money's not there. When it all collapses and people want their money out, it's gone. And of course, he's siphoning off a lot of the money in the process. Another one is Shane Baldwin, Silverleaf Financial. So this one's a little different. He's a recidivist. We had taken a criminal action against him for securities fraud back in 2008, 2009. That was a smaller case, only a couple $100,000, a couple of investors, and he was able to pay the money back. And so he actually got a plea in abeyance. And this is not uncommon in white-collar cases. When it's a first offense, if you have the ability to pay money back, you're probably not going to go to prison. So he kept himself out of prison, paid the money back, gets a plea in abeyance, so that criminal case eventually goes away. But he immediately turned around and started running a much larger Ponzi scheme this time around. So the way he marketed this was he was an expert on identifying loans that were non-performing loans from failed banks and failed credit unions, and he would buy those packages of loans from the FDIC when the FDIC came in and took over a failed bank or a failed credit union. And then he would buy the commercial loans, rehabilitate them, find tenants, you know, because a lot of these were, some of them were golf courses, some were office buildings, strip malls, you know, whatever it was. He'd rehabilitate it and then sell the properties at a huge profit. So you invest in his pooled investment vehicle to buy these FDIC failed loans, and he rehabilitates it and you make a huge profit. Again, a Ponzi scheme. He's not really doing what he says he's doing. He was selling the same asset to four different people, telling them all that they have a first position trust deed on this property, when really one of his companies held the first position trust deed on that property. The difference is these were not small, unsophisticated investors. That $30 million came from only about 20 people. So people were putting, these were very high net worth individuals, many of them putting several million dollars into this investment with Baldwin. Finally, all collapsed. He kind of went crazy. Did a lot of crazy stuff I don't need to get into. But he has additional charges, not just the fraud, because he ends up assaulting a guard in the jail, exposing himself to a female guard. He lost it. Anyway, he's pled guilty. Was sentenced to 4 to 30 years in prison just this summer. Yeah. Yeah, good question. Yeah, so in most of these cases, a receiver gets appointed to go out and marshal all of the assets of the business. Like in D. Randall's case, there was a bankruptcy trustee that's appointed, and he's out marshaling all the assets. And like those insurance agents that got commissions, part of the agreement with us was they had to disgorge any commissions they received, turn those back over to the trustee, and the trustee pays them out to the affected investors. But as far as how much can they really marshal, yeah, it's pennies on the dollar. You're not getting 100% back here, no way. You know, if you're lucky, you're getting 15% back. Probably more typical is in the range of, you know, single digits, 7-8% that might go back to the investors. It depends on the case. It depends on what assets are really there.
So you went back to the advisors, the agents in this case? And
required them to disgorge commissions.
Yep.
And some of them, of course, it's very expensive, and a lot of them didn't have the money, and so they're on a payment plan, having to earn that money and pay back the commissions they received over a few years. It can be extremely painful. Last thing I want to cover before passing off to Ken is our Whistleblower Act. Utah is one of only two states in the country that has a state-level securities fraud whistleblower law. So if you report something that you suspect is in violation of our securities laws and we bring a successful enforcement case, you get a reward. Let me say that again. You get the reward. The thresholds are low. Yeah, so we just have to collect at least $50,000. That can be either through criminal penalties, administrative fines, whatever, or even restitution. If we collect at least $50,000 and have a successful case, the whistleblower can get up to 30% of all the money we collect. So I'll give you an example. Yeah.
Do we have to file an outside business activities report?
No. You do not. It's not an outside business. So you report. So I'll give you the example. The first one we granted was in 2014. A licensed investment advisor down in southern Utah. He was attending a Southern Utah State Planning Council meeting. Our investor education coordinator was down there presenting on elder financial abuse. So she gives this presentation, talks about how seniors get taken advantage of, the warning signs, things to look out for. He comes up at the end of the presentation and says, hey, I got a client who I think exactly what you're describing, I think this just happened to her. So in going through her finances, he sees this $100,000 transaction that when he asked her about, and she was a widow, she was like 82, she couldn't really explain very well what had happened to this $100,000. He sees it going out to this guy, Richard Loveday, and when he asks her about it, she says, well, yeah, he's a really nice man. You know, I knew his wife through some multi-level marketing company that they were both in, and then he came and told me how he could make a lot of money for me. And I gave him $100,000 to invest in his business. And he thought it sounded fishy, so he tells our investor education coordinator, he follows up, calls us, sends us the information on who she is, you know, who she sent the money to, and the bank information so that we can follow up. So we subpoena the bank records and find out that this $100,000 investment that went to Richard Loveday, within 30 days, all of that $100,000 is spent on personal expenses by Richard Loveday. Okay, well, that doesn't sound like an investment in his business. So we quickly get involved, get to AG's office. They bring criminal charges. Within 2 months, we're able to get him arrested because it's early in the process. There were still assets, and we got her $100,000 back. And he pled guilty. He was actually wanted in Canada at the time. He had done some stuff up in Canada before where he was wanted by the Canadian Royal Mounted Police. Pleads guilty, pays the $100,000 back, we deport him to Canada, and he's arrested as soon as he gets to Canada to face other charges there. But the story for this investment advisor is because of one conversation and then one kind of follow-up email to us with the information, he got $15,000 just for tipping us off. And he had no more information than, hey, this looks suspicious to me. He didn't know that Richard Loveday had stolen this money. He just thought that the story didn't add up, and she's probably vulnerable, and she may have been taken advantage of. We were able to confirm that by subpoenaing bank records and looking into it. It's a great ending. That's what we're hoping for. Because normally, we don't get the case until, you know, there's blood on the floor. All the victims have lost their money. Nobody's getting paid back. Then it comes to us, and we'll bring a criminal action against that person, but the money's gone at that point. It's an incentive to get people to bring us cases sooner. So there is money out there. If you do the right thing and advise your client, hey, I don't think that that machine can really take sand from Home Depot and turn it into gold, and I don't think you should invest in that. If you take the extra step then of also reporting that to us and we successfully bring a case, you're going to profit from that. So why not?
Is that a flat fee
award? No, it's up to 30%. It goes in front of our commission. Once we've brought the case, it goes in front of the commission, and you can, you know, depending on what the value of the information you provided was, you can get up to 30% of whatever was collected. So in this case, it was $100,000. They gave him 15% for just tipping us off that, hey, this was somebody we ought to look at. Okay, I'm going to pass it off to Ken.
Okay, great. So I'm going to cover this.
What did I leave you, 2 minutes?
Five minutes. So that's okay. He's my boss. And he has much.
I'm long-winded.
He has much interesting stories than I have. So how many of you have heard about the DOL fiduciary rule? Okay. So most of you have heard about it a little bit. We wanted to just make sure that it was on people's radar screen, and I'm going to cover this really, really quick. I mean, the main thing about it, it really doesn't involve us at this particular time. The important thing you need to understand, this is DOL, Department of Labor. The enforcement arm is going to be the IRS, not the Division of Securities or the SEC. So, and the reason for that is really that these are employer-sponsored accounts and they're tax advantaged. So that's the reason why the DOL came out with these. They do think that the SEC will be bringing forward its own fiduciary rule is what they're anticipating. This is just a timeline. Just got became effective this year. Plans to actually in the transitioning period is in a couple years. Really, the reason why they did this, the stated purpose for the reason why they did this is really the fact that from a demographic standpoint, the fact is people have not saved enough money for retirement. So by just taking in the idea that if you leave more money in the account, pay less in fees, the end result is going to be more money saved at the time of retirement, and that's really the reason why the Department of Labor has pushed forward with this. A couple things with regards to being a fiduciary. Now being a fiduciary, it's kind of defined as what you do, whether you're an investment advisor or whether you're a broker-dealer, and how you're being compensated. The new law takes all of that and throws it out and basically says, if you give advice and if you're compensated, you're following under these rules. As far as recommendations, very broad definition about what a recommendation is. You can see that basically if you talk to anybody about investments, whether it's securities or non-securities, that's a recommendation. Recommendations then lead to making advice. Advice is essentially, if you talk to people about the recommendations that you make, that's providing advice. If you receive payment, you're all going to be included in the Department of Labor, best interest of the customer, fiduciary responsibility. You know, one of the real big purposes of this really is to make sure that conflicts of interest are disclosed and you are acting in the best interest of the client. Education communications is one of the aspects of this. Yes.
Is the Department of Securities, the Division of Securities, are you guys doing anything to help lobby the application of this best interest standard? One of my concerns, candidly, is that as it's adjudicated, best interest is going to become synonymous with the least income generated or the least revenue paid.
Smallest fee.
That's
smallest
right. And I vehemently disagree with that being truly the best interest standard. That at all?
Really, the industry itself is marshaling everything it can possibly do to kind of discuss that very issue that you have. You know, and the SEC hasn't come out with its side, and they are in a tough situation, and I'll kind of get to that really in the practical considerations. There's an optics piece to it, and quite frankly, the DOL's kind of taken advantage of the optics piece, and the optics piece is if lower fees mean more money to the retiree, then that's a lot easier of a sale than doing something like, you know, saying that from a policy standpoint, we're going to increase everybody's Social Security payments to be able to help offset the shortfall in retirement. So good question. It's a tough situation, definitely. There's a little bit of a squeeze. Digital advice, I'm going to hit this real quick as well. You know, just the evolution of how we look at our digital commerce really started out from a standpoint of business to business. Now when you look at it, it really has become more people have its own digital identity. So this is just saying people are very, very comfortable with technology, and even early adopters, certainly more comfortable, but even if you're not an early adopter, you've gotten used to technology. Many boomers have made a lot of money in technology, whether it's Intel or Apple. So people are willing to look at technology and see the value of technology in the investing world. We've also seen a shift to passive investments. You know, that's the non-managerial stuff, more things that are just kind of on autopilot. Index fund is an example of that. The expectation here is really that the train has left the station. Right now, assets under management is estimated about $3 billion. They're expecting in 4 years it could be, you know, multi-trillion dollars. And you really see this by virtue of the fact, you know, name brands, Fidelity here, Vanguard, E-Trade, basically everybody's coming to the realization that they're going to have a product offering. The concerns from a regulatory standpoint, the SEC has concerns, and really the SEC concerns are the same as FINRA concerns. And that is, how do we deal with the fact that there's really kind of a black box with the idea of the algorithm that people are going to use as the predictor of what they're going to invest in. And really, when it comes down to regulators, they hate the idea of a black box. A black box, by its very nature, doesn't have very good transparency, or preferably, for most people, no transparency. And as a result, there are hidden conflicts of interest that you can't see, and you're in a situation really where it butts heads with the idea and the concept of disclosures, which is fundamental in our industry. If you don't provide the disclosure requirements, that's really the basic element of fraud. You don't provide people what they need to know, or you leave out information that they should know. That's the element of fraud, and that's the basic tenet of investing in securities. Also, a big concern is just the reliability of outcomes, and here is just something from a FINRA publication. You can see you've got one advisor that's saying 51% of a 27-year-old's retirement should be invested in equities. Another person over here is saying 90%. So you can see there's a lot of variabilities. That's very concerning. Also, when you look at other concerns, and we all know there's a science to our business, there's an art to the business. The science of the business, computers do a great job on the science piece. The art, not so much. So if you look at it from a standpoint of some of the things that you might be providing advice on, things like leaving money to heirs and estate planning issues, all of those very nuanced, very specific to customers, the capability of a digital advisor being able to do that, pretty challenging. So really what it comes down to, we can basically say robo-advice is going to be here, it's here to stay, but in all likelihood, it's more going to be a complement to other advice that's going to be provided. People will end up using maybe a certain percentage of their portfolio will be in robo-advice, just like a certain percentage will be in index funds, a certain percentage will be in managed investments, and a certain percentage will be with advisors who help to make sure that money is able to be left to heirs, you don't outlive your retirement savings, those kind of issues. So just like in most manufacturings, there'll be really not a situation where you're going to be replaced. So that kind of is all we've got. We really don't have much time for questions and answers. If you have questions, come up and ask us after. We hope you have a great conference and a great day tomorrow. So thanks a lot for inviting us. We're happy to be here.